Hi, good morning and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host here in Hiroshima, Japan, joined by my partner here.
Hi, I'm Toba Kinoka in Yokohama, Japan.
It's always great to catch up on everything you've been up to and I've been up to. Can you believe it's the end of April? How you doing, Toba?
I was just thinking, it's almost, we're getting towards half a year. I mean, this is crazy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But April in Japan is the start of the business year, the start of the government, yes. The start of the school year, and you have kids. So everything going okay as they adjust to the new year?
Well, my big one's graduated, so she doesn't have to worry about that now, and she's working. But the younger one, he's in the international system, so his school year is actually the autumn. Mm-hmm. But we've seen like around us swarms of kind of new first years with their little backpacks on, all sort of being shepherded from the station to the local schools. And so, yeah, it's sort of always a reminder. It's like, yep, this is the start of a new year.
Yeah, with the fresh uniforms, the fresh bags, right? It's a nice time of year to be here, right?
It is. And it's always, it makes me laugh. And I was sort of driving somewhere the other day and I stopped at the traffic lights and this whole sort of horde of these new little first years kind of shot across the road with their massive backpacks, and they're so big compared to the kids, they look like beetles kind of running across the road. So it's very sweet, and so nice that we're in a place where it's safe for the kids to walk to school by themselves.
Absolutely.
So one of the things I really, really appreciate about here.
Yeah, I remember being really worried about my son, especially at 6 years old, walking to and from school by himself. But when I went and shadowed him from away, you know. And then you see how locals will come out and help people across the street, get the kids together. Everybody should do aisatsu. Please say hello to everyone. Yeah. And so it's a lovely part of being in your community, right?
It really is. It really is. It's very nice. So
good. Yeah. So I just came back from the Minka Summit, which was last weekend. We're going to talk about some exciting events that you were at as well. So you can see, we had wonderful weather once again, and this is in rural Kyoto in a beautiful village called Hanase. And once again, you see the frame there, they had a big Minka mall. So you could see people with traditional tools demonstrating. For example, I caught a short video, which is on my YouTube channel, of an American guy who was trying this out, and he was telling me, I don't have to use my muscles. Like, it's all technique. It's not power. And that was really interesting. And then I had a chance to work with Emily Kaneko Reynolds, who I've had on the show. And she's a traditional plasterer, natural plasterer. Yeah. And she had her workshop set up. So I've done some indoor plastering before, but this is when you're making the wall. How do you push the straw and natural clay through? And man, it was so interesting and exciting to be able to learn that from someone who's such an expert, you know.
Brilliant.
And then I was part of a couple talks, so I did a talk of my own on the last day, but on the first day I had a chance to moderate for Ian Davey, who is based in Kyoto for university where he teaches sustainable development. It's so rare in Japan, but he's actually teaching it. But he's living in Shiga, has for many years, and he really redesigned the house that he bought in a very sustainable way to have natural air flows so that you have cool air coming through from the basement in summer. And you close it off, you have a fire and you keep it warm in winter. A lot of great strategies and innovation. He also explained about how he got a local car mechanic to retrofit his diesel car so that now he collects tempura oil from local restaurants and he can drive on tempura oil. So he filters out oil. And he can reuse that. And then explaining how actually when diesel engines were first introduced, they run on vegetable oil. So it is something you can convert back. He also had a compost toilet. He just had so many great innovations that he's really trying out, putting to work. to really try to live as low carbon as possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was also fun to have his daughter there, teenage daughter. And I was asking her, how is it, you know, like how, and he was saying in his talk too, well, my daughter's here, so I have to tell you, you know, heat is becoming more of an issue. We never had air conditioning, but now it's getting hotter and hotter in summer. So yeah. Maybe we need air conditioning, you know, so very practical approach, like trying to do as much as you can, but we got to live in this world kind of attitude.
Right? Exactly. Exactly. And it's about finding that balance, isn't it? So yes, you might have to make compromises with some things like the aircon. Otherwise, it's just not livable, really, or not. You can't be functional in the heat and the humidity we get here in the summer. But, you know, if you're really cutting back your impact in other ways, then hopefully that's balancing out. And also, I guess, choosing the energy, where your energy comes from for the aircon and so on.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And I know you've just moved into a new place, so you've made some good choices too about choosing secondhand refrigerator, for example.
Yeah, secondhand. So I'm very happy with my secondhand fridge. And, you know, sort of I looked at the new ones to see what sort of prices they were, and they're so expensive. And also, you know, at my previous house, we bought a secondhand fridge probably, when was it, 2009. It was already 3 or 4 years old, and it's still perfectly functional. So that one's still going at the other house. This one is a few years old. I think it's like 4 or 5 years old. It's perfect. It's got one tiny dent on the side. Otherwise, it's immaculate, runs beautifully. And it was significantly cheaper, so much happier for my pocket.
Now, unlike air conditioners or like air conditioners in your car, sometimes you need to get more of the I guess, chemical put in so that it keeps refrigerating. But not an issue for secondhand refrigerators, huh?
I think not the more modern ones. Maybe in the past that might have been an issue, but I think the modern ones are really so good that hasn't been an issue for me in my experience. Maybe others have had different, but I've been really impressed with what's available. And when we started looking up for, you know, also bought a secondhand washing machine and things like this, but like, we don't need to buy these things new. There's a whole load of them. People move all the time. I moved on the 1st of April. So also, you know, it's a time when a lot of people in Japan move around, start of the financial year. Like you said, people get rotated around jobs. All of a sudden, there's a flood of stuff available. And there were so many places with secondhand appliances. You can basically go and kit out your whole house very reasonably. You're not buying new appliances. There are a lot of options available.
And then for having a kid who's creative, you also found that the boxes are pretty fun toys, right?
Exactly. So we've obviously, you know, been lots of boxes of different sizes as we've moved and had to buy some stuff new as well. Kept my son entertained for hours. He's been a robot. He built a massive fort. We ate dinner in the fort one night. Who needs expensive toys, right? Just a few cardboard boxes and a couple of sort of throws or something, and there you go.
That's so much fun. Another talk I really enjoyed, which I'll talk again to Chuck Kayser tomorrow on the show, so join us live as I catch up with Chuck online. But I was really impressed by his seminar about farming and gardening, and he's starting to do more education, bringing families and bringing school kids to the farm and just planting together, even playing Uno. He's a father himself. He's taught for years. So he's using a lot of his teaching skills to also just familiarize people back into the natural world. We know that in Japan, there's such a steep decline in farming and gardeners. And he did talk about some of the challenges with pests, with animals. You know, how do you keep the animals from eating all your stuff? Especially monkeys is really challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, such a great talk, and a lot of people with really good ideas who are trying to garden or farm themselves. So that kind of practical knowledge at Minka Summit is always something very popular.
That's brilliant. Yeah. And we're hearing some really good examples of that. I mean, obviously that's one, but I know in Tokyo, John Walsh for years has been doing sort of urban farming with companies and things, but also with schools. He works a lot with schools, helping them create gardens in like the little pockets of land that they have, even in really, you know, schools in the middle of Tokyo, and helping the kids understand the whole process of growing food and actually get involved in it. And then Eli Hirano, our colleague in Kyoto, or just outside Kyoto, is working with sort of local communities there, and they're getting involved in sort of agriculture, repair cafes and things like this as well, and kind of just helping people reconnect with the real world, really, and how things are made and where they come
from. Yeah, and this is really, that's something that Emily Smith, in the talk I did with her this month, she talked about forest foraging. And those little two cute dogs, she said, are actually rescues. One's from Korea and one is from Greece. And they are amazing at helping her find food in the forest. Like they know what to look for. They know what not to eat, that kind of thing. Yeah. But she was also talking about educating with her community and learning from locals, elderly locals, about which things to forage. Because every area is so specific, but how she was shocked how a lot of people don't even know the basic things that you can forage of the younger generation. Yeah. So another example of kind of this lost knowledge, things that are usually passed on in the rural communities, and you know, this lost knowledge. So she's been documenting as a filmmaker, documenting the micro seasons. And I encouraged her to write down, you know, a lot of her stuff. She would write a great book.
Yeah.
You know, wonderful photos and everything. So
brilliant. No, that's really good to hear that we need more of that kind of activity, I think, reconnecting us to the world around us.
Absolutely. And, you know, foraging could be such a survival skill, too.
Absolutely.
Now, you went to a great event on Earth Day, Ichigo Bloom, Earth Day workshops for all generations. How was it?
It was really good fun. So, so Ichigo Bloom, I think we've mentioned before, they do these amazing workshops, climate fresk. They've also got the biodiversity one, plastic one, planetary boundaries one. The one I joined, so they had, I think, four different ones running simultaneously at Impact Hub in Tokyo. And I joined the digital collage. It's the first time I'd done that one. Which was super interesting, kind of looking at the impact of our devices, our lovely phones, the computers we're talking on right now, all of these sort of gadgets that we have, and the how these are made, the impact of their whole life cycle through from sort of manufacture through to end of life and e-waste, you know, being a huge issue and all that kind of stuff. So that was really, really interesting. Highly recommended doing that. And it was interesting because they'd planned to have a kids sort of climate one as well, as a kids version of the climate fresk. Unfortunately, there weren't enough. So the kids, several of them that had signed up, didn't actually arrive on the day. So it ended up being just my son, who's 10. And so he, rather than doing it by himself, he actually joined the biodiversity collage and sort of with a group of adults, and actually really enjoyed it and was able to kind of actually get involved. And it just sort of coincided with a unit he's doing at school on the kind of the natural environment and stuff like that. So it was kind of nice. He felt that he was able to actually understand quite a lot of what was being talked about and contribute some ideas and things. So they were super inclusive. I really appreciate that. And it was a great mix of people. The facilitators always do a wonderful job. So it's always any of their events, I'd highly recommend. You know, they're always eye-opening. Even if you think you know about these issues, you'll learn something. Very, very good.
That's awesome. And you also went to another event, which they're actually doing today in Tokyo at Big Sight, right?
Yeah. So Sushi Tech Tokyo is, so sushi is nothing to do with sushi. It's Sustainable High City Tech Tokyo, I think is the full title, shortened to Sushi Tech. So this is 3 days every year. It's massive. It's at Tokyo Big Sight. They've got two floors, hundreds of booths and presentations and workshops and demonstrations.
So yesterday and the day before were the business days. Today's the public day. I'm pretty certain you can still, I mean, it's running all day, as you can see. I'm pretty certain you can still get tickets. Just go and register on the site if you're in Tokyo, and then, you know, make your way to Tokyo Big Sight. You can see we had Koike-san. We had the Prime Minister speaking on the first day as well. You've got sort of people coming from all over the world, investors, startups, incredible innovators. And there was a great sort of feature on different healthcare things, biotech and stuff like that. And of course, robotics and AI and all the things you'd expect at a tech conference, but also a lot on sustainable solutions and sort of climate tech things as well. So I did spend quite a few hours going around. So I was doing a session on one of the stages on diversity and inclusion with some of the participants from a 6-month cross-company program we're working on. So these were the audience interaction coming up. We asked them, what does diversity mean for you in a business sense? And we saw things like, obviously, psychological safety understanding coming up, but also innovation, unexpected ideas, enormous potential. So it sort of tied very closely into the fact that, you know, if we're looking to innovate and find solutions to the challenges we're dealing with, we need diverse voices in the room, diverse perspectives. So that was good fun. But yeah, there were so many interesting companies there.
That sounds fascinating. Is this your DEI team?
That's our team. So we've got on the right is Kyra from Maersk, the big Danish shipping company. My daughter Amelia, who was sort of doing our tech in the background. And then the two guys there. So we've got Eishiro and Yuki-san from Coloplast, a Danish medtech company. And then Ruri, who is part of the sort of organizing team for Tokyo Innovation Base and Venture Cafe and IVS in Kyoto, a big startup event happening in Kyoto. She's heavily involved in that as well. And she was one who kind of invited us in to do the session. So if you're interested in that kind of world, look up Ruri Nagamori, and she's always posting about interesting events and things happening. So yeah, it was good fun. Really good
That's
fun.
Awesome. I was just reading about Maersk and how they're collaborating with Ocean Cleanup to help them capture a lot of the plastic pollution in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's a wonderful tie up to not have to create your own fleet to clean up the ocean, but collaborate with ships that are already in action, right?
Yeah, and it's a win-win, right? Because it helps Maersk and the other shipping companies sort of meet their climate goals and things. But then if it can help these wonderful, innovative organizations also do the work they need to do without huge outlays and things, fantastic. It makes perfect sense.
That's wonderful. On the Friday of the Minka Summit, so last Friday, we had a chance to visit 150-year-old Machiya, which is a Kyoto-style, like, old tea house. They're very typical to have the garden in the center. This is Jeff Berglund, and he has lived in and worked in Japan for many years. This is an old Machiya he had the chance to buy and renovate. And he's one of the few international residents who has one. They're very, very difficult to get. And so many interesting insights as we walked around from, you know, the tradition of the kind of plants you always have at the front of the house, which is a Buddhist tradition to keep away bad luck. And then the water basin, which is actually a mochi pounding, you know, stand. And it's so beautiful stone, and we can use it, but we can also put water and flowers in it. You know, and then bringing back the central garden, which acts as, a wonderful passive chimney, right? And so you're bringing beauty, but also letting heat escape, bringing oxygen, you know, and like Ian Davey was talking about, creating that natural airflow to make it more comfortable. And these are indigenous traditional styles of house building, which we've lost in Japan, which we know now we got to bring it back because it works so well, right?
Exactly. There's such good stuff. There's so much wisdom there to be had if we have the humility, I think, to get over our addiction to tech and new stuff and whatever, and look at you know, how things were done before. And yes, you know, sure, they can be upgraded or improved a lot of the time. And maybe it's a best of both that we should be looking at. But yeah, there's so much good stuff there if we are prepared to look at it and be open to it, I think.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've been really excited about reading about solar chimneys, which are kind of a new technology, but it's passive technology. Okay. So it's something you can install in your house. It has solar panels to move the airflow a bit better, have that access. But it works in a very indigenous way, bringing the cool air up, but also keeping the warm air in. I want to see more about that because I know a lot of our technology, you know, it's new things, it's innovation, but we also have so many wonderful examples from ancient, you know, Middle Eastern design of houses. That's where this solar chimney idea comes from, right?
Yeah. And also, I mean, we can look to what nature is doing as well, because I know one of the things sort of that this is reminding me of is termite mounds. And, you know, the way that termites, these tiny, tiny creatures that we probably don't think of as being particularly, you know, creative or intelligent, have built the way their mounds are built and designed, and they're huge compared to these tiny creatures, right? So they're really impressive, but they have really stable temperatures inside because they live in places where the temperatures are very extreme. It's very cold at night, very hot during the day, but they've created you know, the sort of airflow systems through so that the temperature inside is really very stable. They can then cultivate their sort of fungus and stuff that they need in certain chambers. And they've got sort of the right sort of conditions created in that by the design of the mound. It's really impressive. So that whole sort of biomimicry school of thought of looking at what nature's doing and then how we can learn from that and apply it to what we're doing, I think is somewhere. We saw some of the startups at Sushi Tech sort of talking about biomimicry, which was great, because I think it's something that we could and maybe should be exploring a lot more.
Yeah, for sure. I like one of the companies you saw, Easy Green Pack. So biodegradable, but also really showing how you can make packaging alternatives, which do go back to nature more naturally, right?
Yeah. And actually, we spoke to the co-founder there, and in a little booth, she had a live demonstration, and it was so impressive. So she had a whole bunch of sort of tote bags and you know, sort of packaging examples there, and they've got different weights of this material, and it's made from seaweed, so from a sustainable source. But it literally dissolves. So she had a kettle there boiling, and she had sort of cut pieces of the material, and with the boiling water, she just sort of took it, she popped it into this clear kettle so you could actually see what was happening. And it was gone in moments. I mean, as soon as it went into the hot water, the water has to be 90 degrees or higher in order to kind of activate that. Then all of a sudden, it just shrinks down, breaks up, dissolves, gone, and it's leaving no pollutants, no chemical residues, stuff like this. It was... yeah, really impressive just to see right in front of your eyes. Like, this is not just talking about it. This works. And it's available, you know, worldwide. She's based in Hong Kong, but they've been talking to investors in Japan, in Europe, in US. So I really hope we see more of this soon. It was super impressive.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's important to realize these are not just problems in Japan. These, if you innovate like this, these are solutions for the world. We're all struggling with these solutions, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we just walked away from that booth just going, wow, wouldn't that be different? Instead of being, you know, given your plastic bags and things, or even the paper ones, which, you know, that's so much more labor intensive to produce or resource intensive to produce. It's like, wouldn't it be amazing if that was the norm? And then it, you know, will be broken down in the soil in just normal conditions. I think it was 75 days, depending on the thickness of the material, or literally minutes in a, you know, hot water. I'm like, wow, that's just, that would be so different.
And then a kind of low tech, but still very effective, talking about good coffee farms and using bicycles as part of the process.
Yeah, this is wonderful. This is so founded by a guy originally from Guatemala, I believe. And he moved to Japan many years ago, realized that, you know, coffee from his home country was actually really sort of respected and popular here, started learning more about coffee, and then realized that it had all of these issues around the ethics, but also, you know, sustainability, environmental impact, and stability and stuff as well. So he started working directly with farmers throughout sort of Latin America to help them sort of create great conditions and have a stable supply. He then, the beans are roasted and sort of sold here in Japan. He does wholesale as well as they've got an online shop as well. But they're using the bicycles to pulp the coffee bean, and what do they call them, coffee cherries. And then they're also using, once that's been pulped and they've got out the juices that, you know, they use to make the coffee, they're using the leftover pulp, which is usually a waste product, then to make other products as well, sort of paper type things and whatever. So it's like, wow, this is so innovative, creative. The fact that they're using the bicycles to pulp it means there's no electricity needed. It's really accessible for people. And there are great videos on the website to you can see this in action. So just so creative and doing good for, you know, in so many different ways. So yeah,
I have so much respect for people that do coffee businesses. You see him putting the big bucket of red coffee berries into the roaster that the bicycle is moving around. I visited a coffee farm in Ogasawara Islands. You can get there from Tokyo overnight ferry. Beautiful natural reserve, and they do have a coffee farm there. And she led me through how you harvest by hand, and pick out the berries. And it's so difficult. And then you realize even to get one berry is so time consuming and labor intensive. And so, you know, if we have more sustainable solutions about how the coffee can be used, more energy saving, but also, you know, better for people, as well as better for planet. You know, these are things we're just not thinking about. We're like taking it for granted, right?
Yeah. Yes. And sort of like creative ways to reuse that waste, which means they're not just, then it's not just coffee that's the product. Is they've got another product as well, which is another source of income, which, you know, hopefully gives more stability as well. Perhaps even if, you know, the quality of the coffee due to environmental issues is not going to be the best, they've still got other income sources as well, which I think, you know, really something we need to be thinking more about. So we need to see more kind of more holistic solutions like this, I think.
Absolutely. And you also saw another business which is like targeting one of the big issues, which we don't have many solutions about, how to get forever chemicals out of our water systems, right?
Yes. Yeah. So this company is looking at sort of, they're a CCU, carbon capture and utilization company. And they are looking at ways that we can sort of, talking about the wrong one. Okay. This is the one that takes the, that's found a way. They had a technology that was originally designed for nuclear waste and dealing with nuclear waste. And then they realized that actually what they were doing could also be applied to removing other pollutants and sort of hard to deal with, like the PFAS, the forever chemicals and stuff. And how do we get this out of the system? But also, how do we break down things where they've got sort of melded materials together, which are very hard to then separate and recycle. A lot of it's lost and therefore not recycled. And of course, in e-waste, that's a massive problem. You've got all these critical minerals, which are hugely difficult and, you know, negative impact in the whole sort of extraction process. But we've got loads of them in our old devices. So it's like, well, if we could find a better way to separate those and recapture those materials, but then also get rid of and actually properly deal with the bad stuff, you know, the pollutants and things that usually are formed when these things break down, then that's really a win-win. So they've started sort of working with this on a small scale originally, but they're now scaling up to a commercial level. They're already working, partnering with quite a few companies, Japan and outside as well. So yeah, that's something also, I think it's a big missing part of our particularly consumer electronics businesses. So really impressed to see what they're doing.
That's great. That's great to see these solutions. It sounds like you were so, you know, you saw so many great solutions and, you know, we always have to remember we can't invest only in future tech or unproven technology, but we need it as well. We need creativity. We need people trying these new solutions, but we also need to realize what's working now. And what we can bring from the past, which was working then, and we made a mistake thinking we could do better, right? We need to go back.
Exactly. So
we need both. We need to think of it from both sides, right?
And there were so many really innovative people. And the wonderful thing is so many of them were Japan-based startups as well, and then taking their brilliant ideas out to the world. So that was really great to see. And I'm hoping that they're going to attract lots of investment and scale these ideas so they can have even more of an impact. So yeah, very, very inspiring. If you're in Tokyo today, go to Sushi Tech. It's worth doing. And the weather's not great, so it's better to be inside anyway.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much, Tova. Once again, always great to catch up. Thanks everyone for joining. And if you're watching on replay and you have any questions or comments, please add them below and we will definitely reply. Have a great day, everyone. Take care.
Bye.